Hello, I'm Bruce Celery.
And I'm Gersh Singh. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple.
You get a twofer. Gersh is going to be joining me in the co-host chair today.
Yes, I'll be interviewing Vanessa Bowen from Mintworthy. We'll be talking about your relationship status with your money. Are you happily married or is it complicated? Vanessa has a test to answer that question and some tips on ways to improve your relationship.
In times of inflation, it can seem impossible to think there is an upside to it. But Money Zen founder Manisha Thakur says there are two surprising benefits. She's here to take us through ways to improve your emotional and financial health when prices begin to skyrocket.
If you're on a budget, it's not always easy to cut costs on food, especially when you can skip the dishes. But Beth Monkel knows a thing or two about crunching numbers and creating inexpensive and delicious meals. She is the founder of Budget Bites, a website and app that shares recipes for small budgets. She is here to share her money-saving tips.
Plus, what do trekking and investing have in common? A lot, according to Salman Ahmed. He is the chief financial officer at Steady Hand Investment Funds, and he joins us to take us through the challenges of trekking and what it can teach us about investing. Plus, how to include your pets in your estate plan. We're going to replay an interview from before I was a cat owner. I am now a cat owner.
This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and by Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Let's get started.
Inflation can be a really scary word, a scary idea, and especially when you look at what you're paying for things in the grocery store, price at the pumps, all of it can be kind of overwhelming. But our next guest says there are actually two surprising upsides to inflation. Believe it when I hear it. Manisha Thakur is the founder of Money Zen. She joins us now from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, not normally where she is in Portland, Oregon, but she's clearly on some sort of cross-country tour here. Manisha, it's lovely to see you.
Well, Bruce, it is wonderful to be here, especially because the cost of fuel is up so high. My airplane ticket out here was a fortune.
Oh my gosh. I hope you have a delightful time. I mean, if you have an indifferent time, it won't be worth the money. Airline tickets are up. Cauliflower is up. Gas is up. I went out for dinner to celebrate my 18th wedding anniversary. Congratulations to me.
Congratulations.
It was a delightful dinner. It cost an arm, a leg, and an ear to pay for this dinner. It was ridiculous. You say, though, that there are some upsides to inflation. What do you mean, you big contrarian?
Yeah. So I believe, in all seriousness, that we can come out of inflation collectively with increased financial health and increased emotional wealth. And there's one primary step we can all take in order to receive those two benefits, increased financial health and emotional wealth. And that is to completely rethink our spending. And, when people say prices are going up, well, there's not a lot we can do about that. But if we spend less, we're not spending more. And so there are a variety of different ways to do this. None of them involve the B word, budgeting. But I really feel like people are going to have an opportunity to assess the relationship between the return on happiness for every dollar that they spend.
Right. So you've dimensionalized this in financial health and emotional wealth. Let's start with the former. What does this mean?
Well, financial health means taking a look at your overall finances and seeing where you might be able to spend some time plugging holes. So let me give you two examples. Inflation means prices are rising, which also means oftentimes that salaries have to rise in order to keep pace with inflation. We also have the Great Resignation going on, so labor shortages, a lot of companies, whether it's your primary job or you want to pick up a side gig, are offering hourly rates that we haven't seen in ages. And so you can use that money to pay down debt. And the thing about using money to pay down debt is it gives you an absolute 100% guaranteed return. If you've got a credit card with a 17% interest rate and you pay down some of that principal, bam, you just got a 17% return. You put your money in the stock market right now, you might lose 17% tomorrow.
Right. How do you have the rigor required to ensure that you don't spend more? So let's take the grocery store, say inflation across all aisles is up 6.5%. If you go in and you buy exactly what you bought prior to that increase in prices, it's going to cost you not $100, it's going to cost you $106 or $107. That's a problem.
Absolutely. And so this is the time to literally rethink everything. So you can ask yourself, A, you know, let me look through, let me go grocery shopping in my own pantry. Because a lot of us have a lot of stuff that we've not used and the expiration dates are coming up on us. So clean things out, make it a game, see how long you can go without grocery shopping simply by eating down what you have. Then when you head into the grocery store, you will actually be in a more creative mindset because you just went through that exercise. I mean, I understand if you've got small children, you need formula and other sorts of things. Those essentials come in, but otherwise you're playing the game. And now when you go into the grocery store, you don't need to buy the same things because you've gotten really clear on what it is you absolutely have to have.
A lot of people have to really deal with themselves when they go into the grocery store because there is a level of entitlement. Like, I am someone who has a job, I pay my taxes, I help elderly people walk across the street. I am a good person. Why can't I buy the same produce and the same meat and the same salty snacks that I was able to buy before this inflation occurred?
Yeah. And I think one of the biggest illusions when it comes to our financial health and our emotional wealth is control. We don't control as much of our lives as we think we do. So we need to identify which are the pieces we can control so that we can survive and let go when the parts we can't control start rearing their heads and terrifying us. We can't control inflation. We can control what we spend to some degree. Obviously, if you have a life-threatening accident or illness, that could come into play. And we can also control what we earn, again, to a limit. There are only, you know, 24 hours in a day, seven days in a week. But you can pick up side gigs. You can do things that are a use of your time that does not drain you of money, but rather adds money while you're going through this process of rethinking what you are spending.
What about emotional wealth? What does that phrase mean for you?
So I have a whole quiz on my website, which is moneyzen.com. And it's a quiz to help you identify what is your level of not just financial health? A lot of us have kind of a rough sense of, oh man, I'm screwed. Or, oh, I listen to Bruce all the time. Yeah. I'm like so golden.
I channel him.
Yeah. But emotional wealth is something that we often forget about in our quest for more, more work, more success, more money. It's like never enough. We're always chasing after more. And oftentimes we forget to slow down and ask ourselves, like, what really brings me true deep joy. And I find that when people rethink their spending, that can be a huge way. And let me just give you a micro example. I'm down in North Carolina visiting my parents who've just moved into a retirement community. So at the retirement community, they have a restaurant area. And my parents wanted to treat me. So we went to the restaurant area for dinner. It was freaking expensive because of inflation. Mm. It was like $20 for each one of us. And honestly, we would have been happier sitting at home making tacos. and so, you know what? There's a good example of the intersection of a financial health and emotional wealth. Recognizing that, we're not going to repeat that experience. And going forward, we'll spend less and have more enjoyment hanging out in the kitchen, cutting all the fixings.
So this seems like a logical segue to your notion of return on happiness. Is that a function on Excel? Can I push a button on Excel to get it to just calculate my return on happiness? Is that in my Fitbit?
I'm telling you, this is our next project, Bruce. We got to come
totally
up
invent
with
this. Yes.
Yeah. It should be like a magic wand.
Yes.
And I really think if people can start me say this a lot over the years, Bruce, like think about for every, when you earn money, most of us work about 2000 hours a year. So if you earn 50,000, a year divided by 2000, that's, $25 an hour before taxes. So if you're going to go out and spend 25 bucks on a bad entree, you can ask yourself, is that worth an hour of my time, in the office or working? And so by using that sort of framework, you can increase your return on happiness, meaning squeeze out as much joy as you possibly can from every dollar that you spend. And when times are flush, the desire to do that, I've been talking about this a long time. I call it joy-based spending, but you really got to kick yourself in the tushy. Now it's a financial imperative because things are freaking expensive. And so, involuntarily, I think those of us who listen to you and your wisdom, Bruce, will want to be taking our finances extra seriously and focusing on return on happiness. Using the equation of financial health and emotional wealth is a great way to make inflation work for you.
One last question here. You do not seem panicked by inflation. And I know it's not because you're a gazillionaire. It seems to be connected to your mindset around money. First of all, is that accurate? You're not nuts about inflation for you as a human? And if so, where do you source that? Where does that come from?
Yeah, I'm not nuts about inflation because one of the things I know about the financial markets is the one thing you can always expect, always, is the unexpected. And we haven't had inflation in a long time. When there are good times, they're followed by bad times. And so I know that the way to be able to ride these waves is to have financial health. It's to always have some best practices, like limiting debt as much as you can, living within your means, making sure you're setting aside some money for the future. And if it's money you don't need to touch for 5 to 10 years, investing it in diversified low-cost index funds and staying put. Always having a cash cushion. So when markets are down like they are right now, you don't have to sell stocks when they're down, which is what kills you, in order to meet your living expenses. You can use your cash cushion. And so when you set yourself up, even when in great times, so the last 5-7 years have been awesome in the market. But if you constantly set yourself up to know some point, the roller coaster is going to go back down again, then you can stay calm when it happens.
Or I can just listen to the sound of your voice and read Money Zen. Money Zen. I could use some Money Zen. Manisha Thakur, thank you so much.
Bruce, always a pleasure.
So great to see you. Manisha Thakur is the founder of Money Zen. She was talking about the surprising upsides of this current inflationary environment that we find ourselves in.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I know, we are a show about personal finance, but today we're going to talk about food, because food is costing so much more than it did a year or two ago. You know, it is very difficult for people in these times to balance, work and life and family and parents and kids and all those sorts of things with the challenge of inflation. Beth Monsell has done a bunch of number crunching on how to be more efficient in the grocery store. She is the founder of Budget Bites. It's a website, it's an app. She shares recipes designed for small budgets. And she joins us now from Nashville, Tennessee, to talk about some of the ideas that she talks about on her site. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce, thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. Why did you decide to start Budget Bites? Were you a foodie or were you a personal finance person? Which came first?
A little bit of both, to tell you the truth. I have always been a very strict budgeter. And about 13 years ago, I found myself in a place where I was not having an easy time making the ends meet. So I started really analyzing my personal budget, and I had already cut out all discretionary spending. So like the only category left that I could even manipulate was food. So I'm like, all right, let's do this. And I started breaking down everything to the penny of what I was eating. And really quickly realized easy ways that I can manipulate my food budget without sacrificing quality or satisfaction. So, and it just took off from there, and I've been doing it for over a decade.
Oh my goodness. What did you notice in those early days? What surprised you about money that you were spending and money that you were spending that didn't derive the satisfaction that you would hope it would deliver?
It's all about the ratios of ingredients in your recipes. So every recipe will have some ingredients that are more bulky. They provide more bulk to your meal, and some ingredients that are less bulky, but might provide more flavor. So what you want to do is really increase those bulky, inexpensive ingredients. And that could be things like beans, rice, pasta, cabbage, all of those really inexpensive ingredients that are usually like the base for a meal, and then scale back a little bit on the more expensive items that tend to add more flavor. So things like cheese, maybe meat, things like that, where you could just add a little bit and it will really add a pop of flavor, but you don't have to go overboard. So as long as you do that, the average price of the meal will stay low. Mm.
What have you noticed about how you use spices differently? Because when you're talking about flavor pop, I know that that's an aisle of the grocery store that a bottle of spices isn't cheap, but it can last for a long period of time.
Yeah, it can last for a long period of time. But in addition to that, it really gives you flexibility in the kitchen. So if you have a well-stocked spice cabinet and maybe a few different oils and vinegars, you can add so much flavor to anything you're cooking and change the flavor every single day. So say you wanted to do a stir fry, you could do a different stir fry every night of the week and just use different spices or make different sauces out of those pantry staples. And that way you never get sick of what you're eating.
I'm on Budget Bites right now, and there's a bunch of sections. I want to ask about meal prep. How important is this step to ensuring that you don't overspend when it comes to food?
Well, planning in general is probably one of the most important aspects, but meal prep itself is probably not going to be for everyone. Meal prep is great for people who are really short on time and they are not too picky with leftovers, because all meal prep is packaging up your leftovers to eat for the next few days. And, you know, that's been something that people have done for generations. So it's nothing new. But I know a lot of people do tend to get sensitive with texture changes or maybe flavor changes with leftovers, and they would rather spend the time and money to make something fresh every day. So it really just depends on where your priorities lie.
What about grocery list prep? Because we know that the retailers play on the fact that we arrive tired, we arrive hungry, and we are susceptible to those end cap displays in which a tower of expensive cereal falls into our cart no matter what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Planning is so important because not only are you going to avoid those impulse purchases or avoid buying things that you might already have in your kitchen and you forgot, but it gets you in and out of the grocery store so much faster. So, I mean, I don't know anyone that really likes to go grocery shopping. So if you take that 5 to 10 minutes to plan before you go, you're going to get in and out of there so much faster and you can get on with your day. But one of the most important steps for grocery shopping that I always tell people is after you plan those recipes and write down the ingredients that you need, make sure to shop your kitchen before you shop the store. So again, you know, you're going to recognize if you're out of an ingredient or if you had something that you didn't think you had so that you don't accidentally buy double. And that's really going to save you a lot of money.
One of the retailers here that we have where I live is they have in their meat section a sticker that says 50% off if you enjoy tonight. And I am like a hunter for those stickers because it doesn't matter if I'm enjoying it tonight. It's something I can pop in my freezer, throw in the slow cooker. Ground beef is so forgiving. It is so forgiving.
Totally.
What are some of the things that you see in terms of shopping the store where you can get the best value? By the way, I don't do that with vegetables. I'm not willing to, I'm not making ratatouille every night.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure how the grocery stores are set up in Canada, but I know in the US, most of the time the fresh items are around the outside, the perimeter of the store, and all the packaged prepared foods are kind of going to be in the center. So if you stick to that outside rim of the store, you're going to pay less because you're not paying for the convenience of things that are already prepped. So you do have to have a little bit of extra knowledge for how to prepare things, but you're going to save so much money if you're buying the raw ingredients and preparing themselves. And a lot of people have a misconception that it takes a lot of work to prepare things from scratch, but there are so many really quick and simple recipes out there. So just stick to recipes that are simple and not the elaborate, fancy, you know, things you see on TV, cooking shows. Just keep it simple and you'd be surprised how satisfying and easy cooking from scratch can be. And that's really going to be the most budget-friendly way to cook.
One of the things I love about your site is the recipes. I look at them and go, oh yeah, I could totally do that. They include the dollar value. So often recipes and food packaging includes nutritional information and calories and all that stuff. But the tuna patties are 77 cents each. The lemony cucumber couscous salad is $1.08 a serving. The pesto mozzarella roll-ups, 59 cents each. How do you make that calculation? That seems complicated. Is it simpler than I think?
It is simpler than you think. And it is something that I encourage everybody to do at least once, because it is an incredibly eye-opening experience. So my prices do come with a disclaimer. Those are the prices I paid. Obviously, it's going to be different for every person, depending on where you live, what day of the week it is, what store you're shopping, et cetera. But the reason it's still helpful for people to see what I paid for the ingredients in that recipe is because then you could really see that ratio that we were talking about earlier. You can see how one ingredient might totally double the price of a recipe compared to another ingredient that might just increase it a few cents, you know, if you doubled the amount. So I think it's really helpful for people to see the price breakdown. And I do have a tutorial on the website about how to cost out recipes. So if people want to try it themselves, we have a step-by-step guide.
Now, there's oversimplifying here. There's two types of retailers. There's everyday low price or everyday high price and high-low retailers. High-low, some prices are just egregious. And if you're not sensitive to price, you can really overpay. But they also have those door crashers that you think, oh my God, that's so amazing. And that deal that I got on that thing was so amazing. What are the types of foods that you will buy and stock up on? And I'll give you my hint. I will buy coffee every time I see my brand for $5.99. I know it doesn't get any cheaper. It's regularly priced at $8.99. When I see it at $5.99, I buy 5 or 6 packages of this particular coffee. It goes into the pantry and on you go. What are the categories that you're on the hunt for that you're quite price sensitive to?
Definitely meat and cheese, because those are usually the most expensive per pound at the grocery store, and both of them freeze very well. So when I do see those deals, I can stock up and I can portion them out and freeze them, save them for later. And it's so refreshing when you realize, oh, I have that ingredient already on hand. I don't have to buy it when I plan to make this recipe next week. So I love having a stocked freezer full of those goodies that I stashed away for a rainy day.
How do you freeze your cheese? I heard this. I tried it. It was a disaster. I let the cheese come. It's not like I put it in the microwave to melt it. Don't think I'm not an animal. But I let it melt in the fridge, and its consistency had completely changed. It was a block of cheddar that I was going to then grate onto tacos.
Yeah.
And it was unwilling to grate onto tacos. It became some mystery shape that I had never seen. Did I just do it wrong?
So cheese does get slightly more crumbly after it's frozen and thawed. So usually I don't suggest it for if you're trying to slice it for sandwiches. It should shred okay, but if it doesn't, you could probably just crumble it with your hands. Another option is to shred it before you freeze it. So you can shred it, portion it into 2-cup baggies or something, and then take it out of the freezer and just use it as you would a bag of pre-shredded cheese that you would buy at the store.
If I were a better person, I would become a vegetarian, because I believe that is low cost. It's better for the environment. I am unfortunately not that person, and I do like my meat. Did you notice that the number of meals or the total amount of meat that you end up consuming is lower than it was before you did this budgeting exercise?
Yes, but it was intentional. So one trick that I often use to reduce my food budget is to replace half of the meat in a recipe with something like black beans or lentils or white beans if it's a chicken recipe. Because yeah, it cuts down the cost a lot. You also get extra fiber and different nutrients than you would if you just had the one ingredient. And I love it. It's so much more like well-rounded of a recipe because you've got more textures in there, more flavors, and it costs less. So it's kind of a win-win.
You have something called a SNAP challenge on your website. What is a SNAP challenge? What are you trying to encourage people to do?
So the SNAP challenge is based on the SNAP benefits, which is a public welfare program in the US where you get a stipend for food and the amount that you get is based on a lot of different factors. So it's different for everybody, but on average, I forgot how many dollars per day it was back when I did that, cause that was years ago. Mm. So I tried to live off of the average benefit that people receive in the US on this program. And it was very difficult and very eye-opening to see all of the social and emotional impacts that I experienced from trying to eat on such a low budget.
$4.50 a day. I mean, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, it's now, for all three meals, not just one.
Right. How do you recommend people sell this plan within their family? There are many of us who have spouses, who have children, who will raise an eyebrow, who might even make a comment about a new way of eating and a budget conscious way of eating. How do you address that objection?
Oh, I wouldn't even say anything. I would just see people notice because
you're sneaky.
No, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's something that you're going to want to ease into. I think any change in lifestyle, you want to take slow one day at a time and just change a little bit so that you don't get overwhelmed and it's not too much of a shock to your system or your family. So maybe just try replacing one of your meals per week. And then once you get more comfortable with it, do 2, 3, 4, and you would be surprised how many recipes on the website we have where people reported, oh, this is something my husband never would have eaten before. You know, he's a meat only person and he loved this. He asked to eat it every week. So I think if you're making good recipes that are full of flavor, full of texture, exciting to your eyes, people are not going to care. They are not going to be like, what? This only costs $5 to make, you know? So right. It's all about mindset and just making sure that your recipes are still pleasing. You don't have to sacrifice flavor or satisfaction when cooking on a budget.
Beth, thank you so much for your insight today.
Thank you.
Beth Monsell is the founder of Budget Bites. That's spelt B-Y-T-E-S, Budget Bites, BYTES.com. There are recipes, tips on meal prep, meal plans, a whole bunch of other things. And there's an app too. If you want some more Moolala, you can head on over to moolala.ca. There are past episodes there that are searchable by topic name, by guest name, or you can go to any of the podcast platforms, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Prime, wherever else you listen to podcasts, and download both the full show or specific segments.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolah Law, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free.
Hello, I'm Gersh Singh. Do you know what your relationship status is with your money? Are you happily married or complete strangers? If the answer is, I have no idea, that's okay, because there's a way to find out. Vanessa Bowen is the CEO and founder of Mintworthy. She is here from Mississauga, Ontario, to tell us about her money relationship status test and ways to improve your connection with your finances. Hi, Vanessa.
Hey, Gersh, how are you?
Good, thanks. So Why is it important to know your relationship status with money?
It's extremely important. And I know it's an area that we don't typically talk about, but your relationship with money, the money stories that you play out in your mind have a direct impact to your financial confidence. And then of course, the actions, habits, and decisions you make every day with your finances.
So you have a money relationship status test. How exactly does that work?
Yeah, it's a very quick and dirty test to really see what is your relationship status with money. So I ask this to my clients and it's A, B, or C, and you have to choose. So A is, you know, are you happily married with money? So are you spending time with your finances, looking at your accounts? You have some positive stories or money mindsets that you're holding. Or B, are you strangers sleeping in the same bed with your money? So this is a person who, you know, maybe has a handle on their finances. They know money's there. They're existing and coexisting with their money, but they're not really building a relationship with it. They don't have a future plan with their money. Maybe they're not saving for retirement. They're really living day to day without any future planning for their finances. And then C is, are you in a secret love affair with money? So this is the person that has those avoidance behaviors. You know, they only look at their account when it's safe, when it's payday or the balance is good. But most of the time, they're really in this avoidance behavior. They don't look at their accounts. They don't know how much debt they're in. They're really just living day to day and not having a good handle on their finances.
Wow. Well, I wish they had that around back in the days when I was online dating. That would have been a perfect quiz to have. Right? What are some of the ways to improve your relationship with money if, let's say, you fall into a category that you're not too happy with?
Yeah, great question. And, you know, it's very similar to our relationship with anyone in our life. You know, first and foremost, how do you speak or communicate to or with money? So what are you constantly saying to yourself or to others? Are you saying, well, it's hard for me. I'm bad at money. I'm always going to be in debt. I'm never going to get out of debt. What you say really will determine your financial confidence and of course those money decisions. So if you're saying, you know, well, I'll always be in debt. I'm never going to get out of debt. You're likely not going to have a debt repayment plan, or if you have one, you don't stick to it. Or you're likely to say, well, I'm in debt anyway. What's another $100 on the credit card? So the way you speak or communicate to or about money has a direct impact on how you manage that money. So watch your words is what I always say.
And that's really helpful for someone who might fall into, you know, the relationship status that might not be too favorable. Yeah. But if someone is happily married with money, how can they maintain that relationship?
Yeah, great question. Same thing. You know, how are they communicating about money to themselves? Really making sure that they've got the positive affirmations and money mindset going, but also, you know, how much time, quality time are they spending with money? I always say this, like you have to date your money, just like any partner in your life, you go on a date with your money. So I have my clients do weekly money dates. So if you already have this healthy relationship, continue that with the same way that you would strengthen your partnership. Have weekly money dates with money where you sit down and you look at your budget, you look at your financial goals, you see where you're spending, and you make those proactive decisions as opposed to waiting till it's too late and being more reactive. So the same way that we maintain our relationships and our marriages, for instance, it's the same thing we have to do with our money to continue to have that healthy relationship with it.
Okay, so I want to focus on writing a love letter to money. Singing money, money, money is not working for me. So how does writing a love letter to money work?
Yes, great question. This is a very powerful mindset reprogramming technique. But the first thing is you actually have to personify money. So think of it as like an actual human, whether it is your partner or your best friend, or make up some fictitious person, but you really just look at money as a physical person. And then you write down, you know, how have you maybe mistreated it? Really just asking for that forgiveness. Maybe you've made some bad decisions in the past. Really just get it all out, because a lot of the times we're walking around with our financial mistakes and we haven't released them. and they're impacting our present day decisions. So you write down all the things that you've maybe done wrong, and then also flip it to how you are really feeling appreciative or gratitude or this love for money. And you're going to see the ways that it has showed up for you. And it's going to start to shift the way you see money going forward, the way you treat money going forward, and your overall relationship with money will improve.
Excellent. So I've got some journaling to do. And I'm curious, how would you describe your relationship status with money?
Yeah, great question. I'd say now we're happily married. Before, I definitely would say we were strangers sleeping in the same bed.
Well, it's good to know that you've made progress. Thank you so much today for your time, Vanessa.
Thanks, Gersh.
Vanessa Bowen is the CEO and founder of Mintworthy.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Stay with us. Coming up later, do you have a pet? Amy Dietz-Graham from BMO Nesbitt Burns is going to be here to talk about how to include that pet in your estate plan. I know it sounds morbid, but it's a super smart step to take. But first, all things trekking and investing. There's actually a lot that those two hobbies have in common. Salman Ahmed from Steady Hand Investment Funds will be here. If you have a question or a comment or a story idea or anything you'd like to let us know, our email address is ask@moolala.ca. ask@moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Investing can be a pretty big challenge. You can experience ups and downs, maybe some blisters and bruises along your journey. The same could be said about hiking and trekking. Salman Ahmed is Chief Investment Officer at Steady Hand Investment Funds. He's trekked all over the world, in places like Cambodia, Sri Lanka, Vietnam. And we are going to take that experience that he has in the mountains and bring it to the stock market and to investing and look at some of the lessons that carry over. Salman joins us from Vancouver, British Columbia. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce. How's it going?
Okay, so what was the very, 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 very first trek you remember doing? Was it a hike around the neighborhood, or did your family like throw you in a backpack and, I don't know, dump you on a mountaintop somewhere?
You know, honestly, I was pretty late to the trekking game in my life. The first one I recall doing I grew up in the Lower Mainland here in Vancouver, so we did some, you know, multi-day hikes here. There's one that jumps out as Thetis Island, off the coast of Vancouver Island, which was, I think, a 3 or 4 day trek, which was super fun. I think it might've been 15, 16, but I didn't do a trek after that until maybe I was in my mid 20s.
Yeah. Okay. And if you had to choose one, just one, which is the one, the single best trek or hike that you have done? It could be multi-day, it could be a single day, right, anywhere in the world, with bonus points for challenge of distance. Like, it can't be the grouse grind. If you choose the grouse grind, we're going to start again.
No, this interview is over. If I choose the grouse grind. No offense to the grouse grind.
I love
challenging in its own way. No, I've been pretty, like you said, I've been pretty lucky in the diversity of treks I've done: jungle, canyon, volcano, mountains. But for mountains specifically, nothing compares to the Himalayas. They are the Alps on steroids. And I'll put it into context. The tallest mountain in the Alps is in Mont Blanc, probably 4,800 meters, 4,900 meters, something like that. Valleys and passes in the Himalayas are that high. No one even looks up at mountains that are 6,000 meters high, because you've got 7,500, 8,000 meter peaks. So once you do the Himalayas, unfortunately, some other mountains start to look like pocket-sized versions of mountains. You can't help but compare what you're seeing to just the sheer magnitude of the Himalayas.
Well, if it wasn't abundantly clear, I'm a big trekker and hiker too. We'll be off to the Dolomites this summer. Oh, beautiful. We did the Tour Mont Blanc a couple of years ago. So I love all that. I have yet to go to the Himalayas because I have this monstrous child and you have to travel to the Himalayas in, you know, times that my kid's in school. Yeah. So I'll use the Himalayas as a backdrop here, but I want to tease out what some of the similarities are between the practice or the hobby of trekking and investing. First one you would say is be realistic. So draw the link here, trekking and investing.
Yeah, you have to be realistic about a number of things when you're investing. The first thing you need to be realistic about is your investment knowledge and the time you have to spend on your portfolio. And that often drives, for example, whether you're going to do it yourself or whether you need to use an advisor. And when you go trekking, it's the same. How experienced are you as a hiker and how familiar are you with what you're embarking on? Can you go on it on your own or is it better to hire a guide? Mm-hmm. I mean, you've probably encountered that person who's on their second day of a multi-day trip and look completely out of their depth and you don't want to be that
wearing
person.
Flip-flops.
Yeah.
On scree.
Exactly. And I'd say another thing with being realistic is just being realistic about your expectations, right? The markets have their ups and downs and it's not a smooth ride. And when you go trekking, you need to manage your own expectations about the trek. Not every day is going to be fun. There's blisters, there's inclement weather. There's a whole host of issues that you're going to encounter. So just being realistic about your expectations is very important in investing and hiking and trekking.
Number two, have a plan. I can imagine from a trekking standpoint, that's, you know, more than just a route map. It's in what's in your backpack too. What does that mean when you bring that into an investing context?
Yeah, exactly. Trekking, nutrition, gear, maps. If you're going off grid, your GPS points or where you're going to camp. And in investing, you need to have a plan as well. Sure, you have an end goal. Hopefully you've examine what that end goal is going to be, but you need to do a few things to get there investing. It's not just going to happen if you sit back. It's how much you saved, how long you're going to be invested, what your mix of stocks and bonds is going to be like. These are the nutrition and gear and route map that you need to have in investing as well.
Be prepared for extremes. I am a deluded optimist pretty much in all areas of my life. And so I am the type of person who will, you know, begin the hike and it's sunny. And therefore I believe it will be sunny until the moment I'm back in my car at the end of the day or 2 weeks later, which of course is not how it goes in the mountains. How's that fit with investing?
Well, yeah, I think a great example is right now. We're going through a period of extremes in investing right now. Markets have been falling and there's a lot of worry out there, and understandably so. But if you've been managing your expectations and have that plan in place, then you know that this period of extremes, this period of volatility is part of the package of investing. And in trekking, like you said, if you're on a trip and you have the skills and plan to complete, then you're prepared for those extreme changes in conditions, right? And that can happen in a hurry too, especially in the mountains and even the jungle where, yeah, it's nice in the morning and then torrential rain or sudden drop in temperatures or just some wildlife that you probably don't want to see in your area. So you got to be prepared for those extremes that can happen very quickly.
Anyone with a basic level of physical health can have a lovely time in the outdoors going for a stroll. Anyone with a very basic level of skills, could invest in a low-cost diversified fund, an equity fund or an exchange-traded fund or a mutual fund. But then from there are skills that are required. How do you, and you are not objective in this answer because of what you do for a living, but what counsel would you have for people to determine what level of skills they need to have to invest in a way that is more advanced than just buying a fund? My concern, for younger folks who've not lived through a market correction is that they're overconfident in the skills that they possess and in the skills that are required to ride out volatility.
You know, I'm a little bit more optimistic about these things because my experience is that the folks that are maybe overconfident or haven't experienced market downturns only really know what they're made of when they experience that downturn. And so we often get clients that have done it by themselves for years because it was a bull market and it seemed quote unquote easy. And then you have a period like March 2020 or the period we're going through right now where they experience these extremes and they realize, hey, maybe I need a guide, maybe I need some help, or perhaps they feel very comfortable with what they're doing. So a few things that we always suggest people that are testing the waters is keep track of your decisions and keep track of your performance. It's easy to only bank on or recall the winners and forget the losers and not to compare. And it's easy not to compare with what else is going on out there. And if you do those, then people get a pretty good sense of how they stack up and whether they are truly ready for that kind of adventure.
I want to wrap things up with a connection back to our metaphor here. And that is the trek that you will do that you have not done at some point in the future. For me, it will be a trek in Bhutan. I have not been there. I will go there. For you, what's the one that is keeping you in shape, that is keeping you focused, even though it could be years or decades until you do it?
Yeah, I'd love to do the Inca. I think you might have done it. I'd love to do the Inca Trail. It's been on my bucket list. Like you, I've got kids, so trekking these days is a little bit more planning and a little bit more difficult. But South America in general is an area I'd love to explore. So the Inca and the Amazon are two that are on my
fantastic.
List.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Salman, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Bruce.
Salman Ahmed is Chief Investment Officer at Steadyhand Investment Funds. Coming up next, why you might want to include your dog or cat in your will. Amy Dietz-Graham from BMO Nesbitt Burn will tell us how and why. And if you want more Moolah La, just head over to moolahla.ca. You can listen to past episodes there. You can also search for particular segments by name or by topic. You can also go to the podcast platforms, all of them, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Prime, wherever else you listen to podcasts. You can download the show. You can write a review. You can even subscribe. So the next episode will just show up on your device. Moolah La is sponsored by Home Equity Bank, the provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Here's the big idea. It empowers Canadian homeowners age 55 plus to live retirement on their terms by providing them with a safe and easy way to access the equity built up in their home. And given the prices of houses these days, that equity can be considerable. The funds can be used for whatever the client wants or whatever the client needs. And that could be travel, it could be helping grandchildren, or it could be supplementing their day-to-day expenses. You can access up to 55% of your home's value with no monthly mortgage payments required. Go to chip.ca to learn how you can stay in the home you love without having to move or downsize. That's Home Equity Bank.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Many Canadians have a pet in their household, and they're often considered members of the family, sometimes the favorite member of the family, who knows? So it might seem ridiculous to learn that your furry little friend is legally considered your property, like your car or a piece of jewelry. What? What's happening? So then what exactly happens if your pet outlives you? Should you include your pet in your estate plan? Amy Dietz-Graham is with BMO Nesbitt Burns. She joins us now with some insight. Hello there.
Hi.
Now, I am not a pet guy, but I have many friends who are, and they will be listening intently to this conversation. Why should we include pets in our estate plan?
Well, it's one of the most often overlooked area. You know, when people think wills, they think money, and if they have children.
Yeah.
That's why you have to have a will.
Yeah.
But they often forget, well, what about your pet? What happens in that scenario? So your will is really your final and last word. So it has to tie up all these loose ends. Otherwise, somebody else has to make that decision for you.
So if it's not included, if the pet's not included, who is responsible?
Your executor would be tasked with that responsibility to figure out who's going to take care of the dog or the whatever animal, the
hamster,
cat,
gerbil,
the horse,
yeah,
whatever it is.
And so from a legal standpoint, I want to talk a bit more about how pets are viewed. They're considered property, that's
right,
correct?
Yeah, in most of Canada it is. In Quebec, they have started to make that change where they are looked at as not just property, but perhaps they call it sentient beings. So
what else is a sentient being?
Yeah, us.
Us, humans.
Yeah. So it is starting to change. However, right now it is considered property. So you have to decide where that property goes.
Now, I love that we're talking about this, but really, be honest with me. How often do you see this done where people do include a pet in a will?
It's becoming more common. You find people who perhaps didn't have children where the pet is their child or pet. A lot of people have said that it's a member of their family.
Yeah.
So it's really important.
But like 5% of the time.
I would say at least 50% of the time that when you bring it up, they go,
never thought
about it.
Now, pets, the life of a dog is maybe, 15 years. Could be 17, but it isn't 40. A lot of people write their wills long, long, long before they pass. And updating a will takes time, it takes money. How do you make that inclusion in a way that doesn't require that you go and update the will every 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, so keeping a general clause to say, if there are pets at the time of my death, here's what should happen. So making it a more general statement so that they know what would happen. And maybe you might have different types of pets that would go to certain people. I have clients who have horses, very, very expensive pets. So who's going to take care of that?
And so when you say what would happen, what are some options? What could you put in there?
Options you can put in, you name a specific person. And I'm even seeing people leave a dollar amount to say, here's an X dollars to take care of my pet in the case of my death.
How does a trust work for a pet? And do you have to be a celebrity like Barbara Streisand to set that thing up? Like, it sounds quite complicated. She would do it because she's cloning her dogs anyway.
You hear that all the time. So you think if you're putting your pet in your will, you're usually this wealthy, famous person, maybe very eccentric, but it doesn't have to be the case. There are things such as a pet trust that you can set up a formal document that will say, in the case of my death, here's how the money would be managed and here's what it can be used for. You can make it very, very strict if you want. Generally, what we see in practice is not usually that case. It's usually around a lump sum of money to say this goes to this person for the benefit of looking after my pet.
And if a client said, I don't know, I don't have no idea what a framework would be on dollars, where would you start? Like, what is it, like 5 years of care for the pet? Or is it, how do you think about what's the right amount?
It almost is, it might sound a little silly, but it's almost taking what kind of pet it is. What is the lifestyle of the pet?
The pet has become accustomed to.
What is the longevity of that pet? What health issues does that type of pet usually run into? Because you might want to think about medical care and veterinarian costs, those types of things. So it's almost doing a reverse calculation on the pet's financial plan, if you will, to leave X dollars in the will for them.
I have a kid. We thought a lot about who the guardian would be. We made sure we talked to the guardian before we put them in the will. Does that thinking need to apply here?
It does, because you might perhaps think somebody wants a pet, but maybe they already have one. Maybe they develop an allergy. You might want to have an alternate. Or what if that person at the end of the day just isn't a fit and doesn't want the job to do it? So you want to have a backup plan just as you would with your children.
Now, we know the stats on Canadians having a will at all is brutally low. Somewhere around 50% don't have an up-to-date will, which makes me crazy and terrified.
Yeah.
But there are other parts of an estate plan that aren't just about the day you die. There's the power of attorney. There's the living will. How do we include the pet in those pre-documents or that
pre-thinking? That's a really important point, and I'm glad you brought that up. A lot of people forget about that. What if you fall ill? Who's going to take on that pet? How do they even know you have a pet?
Right.
So you might want to have this documented somewhere so that they know that you have a pet. Somebody's going to be responsible to step in case you become incapacitated for some sort of reason.
Is that called something, or is it just a separate document that's been notarized that says, here is the power of attorney for my pet?
You got it. And you can list it in your power of attorney to say, in the event that this happens, also note that I have a pet and here's who I've designated to help out with that task.
Are there any other, I don't know, myths or misconceptions about this area that you find clients, if they've given any thought to it, that they bring into it?
A lot of people haven't thought about it. So it's just taking the time when you talk about people not having a will, and I still run into that all the time. But a big part of my job now is to really have these conversations and to bring these things to the forefront. It's, you know, have you thought about your pet? And maybe you don't have a person you can name, but there are other options. You can name, a lot of humane societies have different options where you can sign agreements to say they will look to find the best home for your pet. Under what conditions you want to add into that agreement. A lot of them are doing that now.
In a case where a dog is considered a sentient being in the eyes of the law, does that mean I could leave my $10 million fortune to my dog? Is that possible?
Not quite yet. The law isn't there yet. You never know. It could change. But at this point, it is looked at in Quebec. They can set up a more formal trust with that type of terminology in it. However, what we're seeing is not going to that extreme.
It's about care for the dog during its lifetime.
You got it.
Is it even possible to say I'm leaving my dog $10 million, or I need to leave Aunt Sandra $10 million and she's to take care of my dog?
It's leaving it to somebody, some person, somebody that's going to look after it with the understanding that they would use the funds for the benefit of your pet.
Fascinating stuff. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Amy Dietz-Grams with BMO Nesbitt Burns. We were talking about pets and estate plans. So much to learn on that front. That's it for our show today. A big, big thanks to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage.
If you want to stay updated on all things Moolala, don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. Subscribe to the podcast and leave us a review.
You can follow me on social media. I am at Bruce Celery on Twitter, Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. And thank you so much, Gersh, for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you for listening and have a great day.